Looking back at this point of time, from this annual peak of peace and goodwill, human events of the recent past cannot offer us much reason for self-congratulation. In fact, recent world events have been distinguished more by violence and unreason than by mutual goodwill. They revealed three aspects of human conduct: a superficial veneer of poise and civilization. Underneath this, a reservoir of primeval, unreasoning, ruthless passion, and alongside it, a vast but inchoate and inarticulate reserve of simple goodness and human nobility. The Kennedy assassination and the world's response showed up all three aspects in startling clarity and focus. When the news broke, I was in Manila on my way back to Kuala Lumpur. Filipinos, Vietnamese, Indians, Malaysians, Britons, Australians, Japanese, everyone I met and spoke with had varying reactions, but they all shared one. They were all stupefied by the meaninglessness of it. Rereading Mark Van Doren's play entitled The Last Days of Lincoln, I found the same response to the assassination of Lincoln. Why did so much depend on a meaningless act? The mind loathes meaninglessness as much as nature abhors a vacuum. The mind cannot rest without meaning, and the human mind, always moving, always restless, always looks for a meaning to rest on. I believe that this is why people all over the world searched desperately for an easy explanation, some scapegoat, some label such as conspiracy to fix their minds on. Pandit Nehru suspected it was the work of the reactionaries trying to destroy John Kennedy's civil rights program. Chairman Khrushchev, equally stunned, blamed it on the diehards who stood against Kennedy's efforts to end the Cold War. Chancellor Erhard, and probably millions of others, thought that more efficient security arrangements would have prevented the crime. Even President Sukarno, a master of meaninglessness, found a meaning for the assassination in the desperation of what he calls the old established order, trying to thwart the emergence of the new. On the great world stage, the death of John Kennedy was like a Greek tragedy with one significant difference. The Greek dramatists always found a meaning for the fall of heroes in a deep flaw in their character. But this essential element, the tragic flaw, was not evident in Kennedy's character. It was tragedy without catharsis. The flaw was not in the man, but in humanity itself, the perennial flaw of unreason that causes human beings to kill the peacemakers, Christ, Lincoln, Gandhi, and perpetuate the regime of tyrants. Another general response, particularly among Asian people, was a gasp of family insecurity. The communists may denounce the family unit as an outmoded, medieval, primitive institution which should be replaced by the more scientific and modern idea of human beings identifying themselves only with an impersonal state. But this is not what the average man and woman feels deep within themselves. To them, the attack on John F. Kennedy was primarily an attack on a human family. John Kennedy was the head of a family, a good-looking family, a happy family, and above all, a secure family. If such a powerful and intelligent family, with the world's most efficient security arrangements around them, could be attacked with such consummate ease, and their happiness and hopes could be destroyed in 10 seconds, what security was there for you and me? It was this difference, the family idea, that made people feel even more intimately desolate than when they heard the news of the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi, the apostle of non-violence. Will the world learn and remember all the lessons that are to be learnt from this sudden, shocking knowledge of the meaninglessness of hatred and violence? I wonder. From Peking, a new and powerful gospel of hate is being spread, a direct appeal to the darkest passions of people. There is clear evidence that Chinese leaders, bereft of their friends and allies in the communist world, have decided to start a campaign throughout Asia, Africa, and Latin America on the line of color. The theory is that the line of demarcation between the world's haves and have-nots, the rich and the poor, is the same line which divides the white races from the non-whites. They push their erstwhile comrades, the Soviet Union and the Eastern European bloc, bar Albania, still Peking's ally, into the white side of the color line. From Tokyo to Quito, Chinese embassies and their official news agency have begun to push their propaganda. Not long ago, the official news agency of Peking quoted the head of an Asian trade delegation to Moscow as having said that the Chinese leaders, and I quote, had laid the basis and opened the road for the development of friendship between people of the same color. The Soviet feature agency promptly denounced this attempt too, and I quote again, more and more emphasis on the color of the skin. Do they not understand that in China, the significance of this kind of statement is more consistent with the spirit of Genghis Khan than with the spirit of our era, unquote. It would be fatal to underestimate the potentialities of this campaign. To people who will not see beyond the superficial, this color line thing is bound to look like the plain truth. The fact that the non-white people of the world are numerically preponderant and comparatively speaking, also the underprivileged people, is deliberately and cunningly twisted to suggest that one is the cause of the other, that poverty is the result of color in a world dominated by whites. The obvious relationship between population and poverty, one of the principal causes of poverty in the non-white areas of the world, is a rapid and even alarming increase in the number of people trying to share the natural resources which are not being developed, is cunningly obscured. I have recently met even literate and intelligent people, politicians, editors, and businessmen from Tokyo, Manila, Jakarta, Colombo, and Karachi, who have already swallowed this bait, hook, line, and sinker. How much more gullible will be the average man and woman? The visit of Premier Chou Enlai to Africa, Pakistan, and Ceylon becomes additionally significant when it is viewed in the context of this attempt to find allies in an affinity of pigmentation. As in all international political activity, there are plots and counterplots. For instance, the visit of Chou Enlai to President Nasser and other Arab leaders of North Africa is also related to the Sino-Indian dispute and the Sino-Russian conflict in Asia. A major diplomatic battle is being fought in Asian capitals where the Soviet Union and the Peking government have diplomatic missions. From Phnom Penh to Cairo, in Jakarta, Colombo, and Karachi, the communist Chinese are fighting to win friends and influence people's minds to fall in line with the Peking case against India and Russia. President Nasser was the first to suggest neighborly intervention to stop the border warfare in India. Colombo, the venue of the Colombo Powers meeting, since then has been the scene of intense diplomatic activity by Peking, directed against India and also the Soviet Union, which at first reluctantly, then openly, came out on the side of India. Indonesia, where the Soviet Union has massive economic and arms supply commitments, is another major center of diplomatic activity for Peking. The wooing of Indonesia for the cause of mainland China has to be maintained despite the intolerance shown by President Sukarno towards the Chinese settlers in Jakarta and Bandung. The expulsion of American aid from Cambodia and the recall of the Cambodian diplomatic mission from London also seem to be motivated at least partially by Peking's campaign to separate the East from the West on the basis of the color line. In such a complex of propaganda and ideological disputes, ambitious leaders try to make political capital for their countries and for their own international image. Ever since the Chinese incursions on the Indian border last year, President Sukarno has been calculating the chances of assuming leadership among the Afro-Asian nations. The fact that India was compelled to ask the West for aid enabled Peking to charge Mr. Nehru with becoming a vassal of the West and gave him an opportunity to make a bid for taking over the mantle of leadership of neutralist Afro-Asia from the shoulders of the Indian Prime Minister. And he was prepared to bide his time, making Indonesia the center of the amorphous philosophy of Afro-Asianism. The first outward effort was the conference of Afro-Asian journalists held in Jakarta last May. The next was an Afro-Asian writers' conference. This was followed by the Ganefo Games, the games of the newly emergent forces, and by the conference of Afro-Asian labor leaders. The next major event being planned is the second Bandung Conference of Afro-Asian countries, to be held in the 10th year after the first Bandung Conference, at which the notion of Afro-Asia became an ideological fact. If this conference comes off, both India and China are bound to be present. This then will provide the grandstand for President Sukarno to act personally as mediator between the two Asian giants and stake his claim officially to be the undisputed leader of the concept of Afro-Asianism. But the Indian Prime Minister, wise in the ways of the world, seems to be keenly aware of these moves and is unlikely to fall an easy victim to such machinations. India's appreciation of the situation is behind her support of the counter-proposal of President Nasser to hold the second meeting of the Afro-Asian powers in Cairo. These undercurrents and involutions provide some source to the news that President Sukarno has decided to accept a long-standing invitation to visit India in the not-too-distant future. Added piquancy is provided by the suggestion from President Ayub Khan in Colombo that the developing countries should hold a conference soon to discuss matters of mutual concern. If this conference is held, whether it is to be held in Bandung, Cairo, or Colombo, it should be immensely interesting. Despite all the preparatory work of diplomacy and compromise involved, the sparks are bound to fly in a room occupied simultaneously by Prime Minister Nehru, Prime Minister Chou Enlai, and President Ayub Khan.
Identify themselves. I think that is terribly important. Otherwise, they don't really get into the show and experience it themselves. It should have a worthwhile theme. It should have vivid characters that come to life.
Vivid characters and imaginative staging are the hallmarks of adventure theater. And these are what children, young and old, will see each time the funny little man with his elf costume and the mask of comedy steps out on the stage and says,
"Welcome to Adventure Theater."
You have just heard the story of a theatrical group which produces plays for children under the name Adventure Theater. Your reporter was Jack Weitzel. Join us again next week when the Voice of America presents another picture in sound of people, places, and events on Reporter at Large.
This program has come to you from the United States of America.